This is an ABC podcast.
In the weeks and months of COVID lockdowns, did you seek solace in the arts? Did you take up creative hobbies for the first time, or tune into music, painting, books, movies, and podcasts? The creative arts show us who we are and what we could be. And far from being only within the walls of a gallery or a concert hall, art is everywhere. That's the theme of this inaugural ABC Arts Week. I'm Paul Barclay, and in this Big Ideas, you'll hear from five prominent members of the arts community as they respond to the proposition that art is everywhere. This is Arts and Minds, a series of short talks to showcase the diversity of Australian arts. The speakers are playwright and artistic director Wesley Enoch, stand-up comedian Lizzie Hu, multimedia artist and activist Deborah Keenahan, novelist and essayist Melissa Lukashenko, and writer Sasonke Sasinkwe.
I want to begin by saying Sanibonani. Sanibonani in Zulu means I see you. And I want to extend in particular to my brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers in the Gadigal Nation, Sanibonani from the Zulu Nation. My art form is storytelling. And so if art is everywhere, then I cannot express to you how everywhere stories are. I'm talking about the kind of first-person stories told by regular people, the kind of stories you encounter on non-Kardashian reality shows and podcasts, the types of stories told in TED Talks and on live stages, the kind of stories that simply aren't told through films or in books or in stages, the kinds of stories that are simply spoken out loud. These days, you cannot take two steps without bumping into someone like me, who calls themselves a storyteller. You can't be online for 2 seconds without coming across a story of some kind. So what I want to do is talk about these everyday stories and how they are changing in the digital era and what their everywhereness means for audiences and for those of us who say that we love stories. So some statistics. According to the Nielsen Institute, the average Australian spends 96 hours and 15 minutes online every month. That's about 6 hours and 13 minutes a day. A full 40% of our waking lives are being spent online, which is deeply depressing. But having advocated for the art of storytelling by everyday people for the last decade of my life, the optimist in me wants to see this as an opportunity. Imagine how many stories you can download in 6 hours and 13 minutes. But I confess, my concern outweighs my optimism. As stories are increasingly told and shared online, there is this tendency for storytelling to be seen as an individualized experience, shorn of its roots as a communal activity, a mode of teaching and learning. I often tell my storytellers that storytelling is, in fact, the oldest app for teaching. Stories are, of course, entertaining, and there's nothing wrong with that. Entertainment is good. Art is for entertainment as well. But stories, the kinds that we encounter every day when we are in the business of living with and alongside one another in the messy, smelly, dirty world, they are so much more than entertainment. Stories represent the art of living. So, what happens when stories take the form of audio files or video clips? Shareable and clickable. Part of what happens is that it makes it easier for some of us to avoid the messiness of real-life interactions. We can be experts in other people without ever leaving the comfort of our own homes. It means that we can fetishize and commodify stories. So the story becomes the product and the storyteller a mere producer of that unit. When I first started working with people to help them to shape their stories, which is much of what I do these days, not so much in front of the camera these days, I didn't fully understand this distinction between the storyteller and the story, between the person telling the story and the voice. Okay? We love to talk about the voice. Let's elevate the voices of people of color. Let's elevate the voices of women. And what that means is we talk about a voice disconnected from the actual person. But then I met this woman called Ascala, and I've asked Ascala permission to talk about her today. And she changed the way that I thought about stories. So Ascala was this Ethiopian woman. She was in her late 40s when I met her, and she had been living in Perth for almost 30 years by that time. We were working together on this project. So every month we had this event called Food for Thought. Food for Thought was a gathering around a table. We would invite a community into the office. They would cook for us on a Thursday once a month, and then we would have a spread. And it would be used as an occasion to talk about the community that people were from. So it was a Vietnamese feast, or it'd be a Sri Lankan feast, you know, whatever the case may be. So we decided to have an Ethiopian feast, and it was an opportunity to use the sales of those tickets for the meal to raise funds for refugees from that particular community. So it was a gorgeous, you know, thing. The office would be smelling of food. You know, it was very easy to be distracted on a Thursday afternoon. So I sat down with Ascala a few weeks before the event, and I listened to her because my role was essentially to help the storyteller to shape their story. So what are you going to talk about? How are we going to present this to everybody? So I sat down with Ascala and listened as she talked through what she wanted to say. We have this long blue couch in the office, and we sat together on that couch. And she got to a certain point in her story, and she started to cry. So then I started to cry. So then we took a break, and I said, it's okay, we can continue this next week. Next week, she comes back, and she starts sharing the story, and we get to this point in the story, and she starts to cry, and then I start to cry. And I was like, wait, it's okay, we'll do it next week. And now we are literally running out of time, and all we have done is cry. So I said to her, okay, Ascala, remind me again, why are we telling this story? Like, why have we chosen this particular story? And she said through tears, because Aussies always want to know where you're from. They expect me to talk about my journey. And she was right, of course. There is this expectation that refugees are going to tell refugee stories. Black people are going to tell black stories. As if refugees don't fall in love, don't have hilarious and outrageous stories of getting drunk. God forbid. So I asked her what she wanted to talk about. Like, if you had your choice and people didn't expect you to tell this particular story of how you came to Australia, what would you talk about? And she told me. She told me this story about how when she was growing up in Ethiopia, Ethiopian New Year was this huge event. It was like the biggest thing on the calendar. Ethiopians are part of the Coptic Christian Church, one of the oldest churches in the world, so much like the Greek Orthodox Church. And so every year, the Ethiopian New Year is celebrated around September. It's in a different part of the year from the Greek Roman calendar. And so every year, her mom would spend weeks and weeks getting ready for this event. And there would be lots of excitement. And every year, on the morning of the event, her father would get up and he would give her this perfume, and she would act like she was surprised, even though it was the same perfume that he gave her the year before. And she would say, oh, for me? And then she would open it up and she would spritz it on all the kids. And then he would say, woman, are you trying to tell me that you're gonna waste that perfume? You think I got this from the river down the street? And she would say, oh, I'm so sorry. And the kids would giggle like it was the first time they'd ever heard that joke. So it's a beautiful story. The crowd was delighted and charmed. And instead of hearing something they had heard many, many times before, what they got was a picture of warmth and humor and love, a portrait of everything that she had left behind. Importantly, she chose to tell a story that she could tell without hurting herself. The price of admission when you start a new life in a country should not include repeatedly baring your soul and injuring yourself in order to satisfy other people's curiosity. I tell this story for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it is a beautiful example of one of the first principles of storytelling, which is to tell your story from your scars and not from your wounds. The place where she kept getting stuck, that was still a wound. It was still open, still very sore, even though decades had passed. The parts of her story that made her cry are none of my business. Storytelling is not therapy. But I began to see that my primary responsibility was to help her to protect herself. And this has become a core part of my work as a storyteller. My job isn't so much craft about the story arc and the narrative structure. It is about helping people figure out what they won't say, what they will keep to themselves and for themselves, not out of shame, but out of judiciousness, out of respect for boundaries in a time when there seem to be fewer and fewer spaces in which we belong only to ourselves. or to those few with whom we decide to share stories in the intimacy of a close circle. My job is to say some stories are for everyone and some stories are not. What category does this story fall into? In other words, my job is to help storytellers to think about the politics of stories and how to ensure that they can control their own narratives, no matter how big or how small the story is that they choose to share. The potential to share stories digitally is immense. I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe in it. But it is essential that as we celebrate stories, we remember that stories belong in the bodies of real people. Those of us who are in the business of putting stories into the public realm, we have to remember that if stories are everywhere, then so too are the artists who live those stories into existence. It is really very simple. If we take care of the storyteller, the stories will take care of themselves and they will multiply. Thank you.
Writer Sisonke Sisinkwe. Stand-up comedian Lizzie Hu is next. She says she's not sure that stand-up qualifies as art.
Hello, everyone. I'm Lizzie. I'm a stand-up comedian, a.k.a. the scum of the arts world. It's okay. We know our place at the bottom of the pile with the magicians, just one up from the jugglers and one down from the party clowns. It's fine. It's okay. Our topic today, art is everywhere, I think could not be more appropriate for my art form. I need to acknowledge it does feel weird saying art form, talking about stand-up comedy. I can just imagine all the other comics saying, oh my God, Lizzie Hu went on the ABC talking about comedy as art, lame. Although I guess technically comedy is art, but we're not quite ready to call it that yet. We're too cool, right? We're trying to be relatable, so we don't want to appear all high and mighty and call it art, okay? We might be more confident, I think, to call it art once our category starts being eligible for arts grants. In the meantime, we'll just keep working away, scribbling down our little notes, hoping there'll be art one day. We do see inspiration everywhere. And before gigs, you know, you'll see comedians in green rooms, which is often just a dirty kitchen in a bar, poring over our notes in our phones or in our little notebooks. Some good ones, a lot of not so good ones that will never be told again. And we'll ask each other, is this anything? Before going out to the audience, asking essentially the same thing. Here's a note that I just wrote down today in my phone. It says, inner city hitchhiker, Soviet taxi, cabs for everyone. It's not funny, but maybe it will be if I find the right angle. Jokes, you know, they're everywhere, and then you never know when they're going to pop up. You know, they're conversations you hear on the bus. They're an old colleague who used to keep his value pack of Metamucil on his desk like it wasn't a big deal. A value pack. I couldn't get over it. Wrote a joke about it. Did it on TV. Now that joke pays my bills, which is really weird. Jokes, I think they can be anything. It's something funny your parents said. It's childhood trauma, adult trauma, children you love, children you hate, being pregnant, trying to get pregnant. Jokes, they really can be anything. In my show this year, I started telling a joke about my older brother who, during lockdown, attempted to start a trout farm in his backyard, in an above-ground pool, in his rental, which of course I knew about at the time, but I didn't think to write about it because that's just, the Whos are a bit eccentric. I thought, yeah, that's just normal. And then because I guess we all thought at the time the world was going to end, and sometimes you can be too close to a joke. You have to take a step away. And time had passed. And when I spoke to him about the trout farm again, I thought, why isn't this story about my brother starting a trout farm in his backyard pool in my stand-up? It's too good not to include. You know, I know you have probably a lot of questions about the trout farm. I can't tell you the whole story. It goes for about 10 minutes. But it was during lockdown, and other people, you know, they were baking sourdough and doing puzzles. But my brother was thinking, where are you going to get your omega-3s? That's where he was at. And he bought about 20 trout from a farm 2 hours from Melbourne. And then he came back and drained his pool and then filled it with some tap water. And then went to his local creek and got some river reeds from the Darabin Creek in an attempt to mimic the trout's natural environment. You know, just a few reeds to cover up the bright blue bottom of the pool. And then he lobbed these fish in, hoping that they would procreate and he would become the John West of Melbourne's North. Look, it goes on for another 8 minutes. But honestly, in my show this year, it was a big crowd pleaser in the show, and many people asked me after, like, is that true? Is the trout farm story true? I said, yeah, I can't make that up. But that story, that whole thing, that was art presenting itself to me, I think, on a very nice silver platter. The trout farm was definitely a gift from the comedy gods. And, you know, sometimes the jokes, the idea, they're not like the trout farm. They're a little bit harder to work out. And every night of the week, you'll find comedians in pubs or on the city's outskirts in big RSLs, touring through regional theatres. We're in big city offices selling gags to corporates mid-conference. We're at speakeasies around midnight trying to engage the few left. We're constantly working out ways to give our hastily typed out notes some form of life, you know. We're on TikTok and Instagram, YouTube and podcasts. We write books and TV shows and speeches and ads and memes. It's all very highbrow. A lot of people, they call us brave. Usually that happens right after a bad gig, a bomb, you know, an audience member will come up and say, you're so brave, which is code for you weren't very good, but we admire your courage. Keep at it. You know, very rarely are we in fancy locations with bottled water and our names on a dressing room, although it's nice when that happens. And rarely are we included in arts funding, and if we apply for it, don't tell them you're a stand-up comedian. You're a performer. But we don't care. We don't care. We're used to being paid $50 to travel 50 kilometres to a pub on the outskirts of town so that when Gary looks up from his schnitzel, someone is there to entertain him. You know, I will do that for the community. Look, the notes app or a comedian's notebook is a very dark and sacred place for a comic, but I thought I'd open the vault. I want to read out some of my notes from my phone, my little joke seedlings, which I think is genuinely so brave because these notes aren't jokes yet. They're just weird thoughts and ideas that meant something to me at some point. Are you okay with that, if I read these dark thoughts out? Okay, see if you can make sense of these little seedlings. I've just collected them from my phone. Dogs are the rising middle class. You heard it here first, okay? I'm really obsessed with big bears following families on YouTube. Maybe, I don't know. All we know about America is bad shit and how to barbecue your meats. Mass shootings and how to get that ultimate smoky flavour on your brisket. But Graham could be funny, I don't know. Just been to Bali, wrote a lot of notes there. Old surfer guy in front of me at beauty salon, getting his mullet washed and blow dried. He looked gorgeous. That's it. this note just said, tree ethnic dad. And I remember looking back at that. I was like, yes, I know why I wrote that down. That's in reference to dad putting salt on a neighbour's tree to kill it. That's got to be funny. Barefoot budgeting lose, I don't know. Everyone hates each other. Very profound. That was the note. That was all it was. COVID reminded me of the 90s. Maybe too late for that one now, I don't know. I've even typed out random conversations I've heard at the pub. This one was from two very drunk friends back probably like in 2019. I just remember typing this out and the two guys talking to each other, you got gays in your life, Buffalo? I was like, what's going on here? You got gay friends? How many books have you published? The other one said, if you look up my name, you'll see with women, and then one of them said, with women I become friends with them and then I become in love with them. And I was like, okay, that was the convo. That was never going to go anywhere, but I wrote it down and now I've just shared it with you and I regret it. but sometimes, look, the notes do work. How's this one? This is the original note for the trout farm joke. Big bro trout farm, dot, dot, dot. think of the kids who wanted to try fishing for the first time. He actually said that to me. Something they'd only heard about in the before years. Darabin Creek weeds. That was the original note. And it turned out to be a 10-minute joke. So, yes, I guess art is everywhere. And maybe I am an artist. Am I art? I don't know. Is the failed trout farm art? I'm not convinced, but thank you so much for listening to me. Thank you. I'm Liz Hu.
Stand-up comedian Lizzie Hu. You're listening to Arts and Minds, a series of short talks by prominent artists on the theme Art is Everywhere. Wesley Enoch is an Indigenous playwright and artistic director. He speaks of the First Nation's deep and creative connection to country.
Art is everywhere. Art is in the very fabric of our skies and landscapes and waterways, tying together powerful narratives of creation and songlines, weaving who we are with where we live. Song and dance, music and mark-making, stories, knowledges and practices that have been formed and reformed over thousands of generations. Art is everywhere. Art is in the world around you if you take the time. Take the time to not just hear, but listen to the bird song. Take the time to watch rather than just see the light playing on the rippling water or the changing colours of the sunrise as it drenches the twinkling treetops and escarpments. To watch and learn from, to mimic the movements of the animals, to take the time to take in the smells of the fire and flowers, the rain and the rotting leaves, the smell of a dry wind and the dirt under your fingernails. And if you can wait long enough, to take the time to taste the story of how a place came into being, either through the creation story or the creative story of science. Art is everywhere. Art is in the choices around your home, whether you're conscious of it or not. Those family photos you're so proud of, you went and got them enlarged and framed. The music you ask Siri to play for you, the song you sing to help an elder remember a time long forgotten. The overly optimistic pile of books that chastise you to read them, and the time you take thinking about the exact right words to say to a loved one who needs your help, or that handcrafted object you publicly display because it somehow brings you joy, or maybe it starts a conversation with someone, and the jewelry your niece gave you when she came back from exploring the world. Art is everywhere. Art is in the stories you tell of how your family came to be. The artful stories honed through endless repetition of the journey of your great-grandparents as they took that journey to escape the troubles in search of a better life, or the story of what you left behind to make your own way in the world in search of an opportunity, or how your people have known no other place than this. Let no one say the past is dead, the past is all around us and within. Art is how we make and remember history. Art is a single moment in time we wish to endure beyond this moment to the next and somehow add to the flow of time for someone else to understand what has gone before. Art explains the world around us and gives us a role in it as the receivers of art or the believers in art, creators and contributors, interpreters and promoters. Art is what we do to express the human condition to each other in all of our similarities and our differences. And yet somehow it has the power to create disagreement and discord as well, as we take exception to the artistic intention or reception, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. Art is our attempt to make our ephemeral life substantive. Art can be contrary and messy. It can challenge and cajole. It can affirm who you are and help you be something new. Art can comfort and cause discomfort in equal measure. Art can connect you to tradition and free you from it. It can help you retrace the long track of time and equally have no memory of what has gone before. Art is for the curious character who wishes to see what is beyond the horizon and then goes about creating a world where that journey is possible. Art is the power to shape the world. Art is the power to move people. Art is the power to create change, to tell stories of what is required of us to all evolve. Art is everywhere. Art is at the centre of any culture that values the composition of communities and collective problem solving. Art is soft and contestable, approachable and open to conjecture and opinion in the most joyous way. And at the centre of art is the urge to be creative. And the people who follow their instincts and fascinations, train their senses and take the time to reflect back the needs of society are called artists. Artists are everywhere. The role of an artist is to find the pressure point, the dilemma, the crucial societal conflict, the flaws and strengths, and shine an all too brief light on it, to transport away or travel deeper into the question at hand. Artists help create a vocabulary for a preferred future where we can help imagine an audience, what could be, engaging the mirror neuron effect, where, as humans, we learn from watching and mirroring the actions of others, best seen in how a child watches a parental figure and learns from them the survival behaviours. Art is effectively a way to pave the social change by engaging in needs of the people and give space for the exploration of great moral and ethical problems, to give a platform to debate and discussion and act as a social conscience. When functioning well, art is everywhere and art is influential. The most important question for me at this juncture is that of representation and the role we need to play in the achieving of our rights as First Nations peoples. We seem on a very familiar precipice of change, a place where we have known before, a place where our grandparents and parents have stood and hoped for the change we seek, a change where we relied on others to help shape our futures. A time when we spoke of our aspirations and hopes so that we could change the hearts of a heartless past. And when the newly minted Prime Minister gave his acceptance speech, you could feel a sense of relief and change in the air. And a cousin leant across to me and said, "We're now the dog that caught the truck." Recently, I was at a dinner at a friend's house, and between the garlic bread and the couscous salad, an objectionable fellow guest took great delight in giving me unwarranted advice that there was no way to win a referendum unless we told our stories better. That we posed the proposition in terms of white benefit rather than the righteousness of our case. How the population would be somehow made better through the granting of a voice to First Australians. That the population of a country needed to know our story more, needed to access our pain and suffering to help justify the investment in this venture. I was animated in my response. Not so much that I was angry that decades of truth-telling and sharing and royal commissions and reports and studies and academic papers and talks and debates could be summarily dismissed as not enough, but more because this fork-wielding dinner bomber was again assuming all the responsibility lay on the minority to convince the majority. That we had to play the role of victim for an appreciative audience to persuade them to do what is clearly right today from a historical wrong. It reminded me of a political march I attended as a young man at the end of the Joe Bjelke-Petersen era in Queensland, where we marched and chanted down George Street and we came to the gates of Parliament House and rattled them until they fell off their hinges, unhinged. When the gates fell, there was a stunned silence and no one knew what to do. And I then thought, send in the poets and the painters, send in the storytellers and the dancers, the singers and the law bosses. Let them take charge of the next stage, what is required for this change to happen. They can do that. As the vanilla ice cream and kafuti were being served, I thought, this spoon-dodging armchair reconciliator had taught me a lesson. In many ways, they were right. That the voice to Parliament was not the only thing that was needed, but there needs to be a voice to the people. A healing power of truth-telling, fantastic, but also a storytelling that connects us to our place, brings us together in the appreciation of our art, yes, but also a deeper understanding of our culture and how we live in this country. Art is everywhere, and artists make it real. Thank you very much.
Playwright and artistic director Wesley Enoch. Next is Deborah Keenahan, writer, multimedia artist and activist. Deborah's lived experience as a woman with dwarfism is the inspiration for her art.
I would like to talk with you tonight about art and lived experience. It's everywhere. And the creative challenges. The theme of Arts Week, art is everywhere. That speaks very, very strongly to my own work. I am a multi-discipline artist, and one of the mediums that I work in is performance. I perform in Awkward Conversations in the Big Anxiety Festival. Now, people come, they sign up to their Awkward Conversation, and they know who they're getting, and they get a bit of a blurb. So, my Awkward Conversations always start the same. They come and I go, why me? Why this conversation? I want to know what it's like to be small. And I go, you already know that. I'm about the height of the average 9-year-old, although they are starting to make them a bit bigger these days. Right. So, you've been 9? Guess what? You know what it's like to be small. And they go, yes, but I want to know what it's like to be different. And I go, you already know that. Look around the room. There is nobody who looks exactly like you. Even if you're an identical twin, there are still differences. So, you already know what it's like to be different. Yes, but. And I go, but. This is a different kind of different. Okay. Yes! I've named the elephant in the room. And that is what my work is about, this qualitative difference. And I endeavour to capture that in my work. So, in my work, what I endeavour to do is immerse people into my world. And a big part of my world is that I say my dwarfism does not disable me. What disables me is people's attitudes to my dwarfism. And that is what I call and write about as critical disability aesthetics, when the person meets society, meets those attitudes, and it is those attitudes that put a layer of exclusion, discrimination upon the individual that is much greater than the physical limitation that they may have. And the joy of art is that it has the capacity to communicate this incredibly complex concept and to do so quite readily. I want to now discuss a sculpture, Little Big Woman, Condescension. This work shows a stance that people with dwarfism are so used to, being spoken to like a child. Now, this image, this sculpture, is on a plinth. It is at that height, so somebody of average height walks around the work, and basically they are constantly being in the ever-present gaze. In my practice, I am multidisciplinary because I enjoy the challenge of different mediums, their capacities and their limitations. But also, I am aware, as a psychologist, that people take in information and understand and learn and engage in different ways. Visually, auditory, kinesthetically, experientially. And basically, for me, I want my work to be accessed by as many people as possible. And basically, to be experienced, enjoyed, and engaged with as many people as possible. And that I do through using different mediums. I'm trying to immerse people into my world. So I aim to creatively change perspective and point of view so as people understand the perspective of those who are often seen as an other. And in doing so, hopefully increase understanding and empathy. My work at Kashula, a solo exhibition, again, employing many mediums, I engage people with lived experience in the physical. You may see the chairs there, the larger, taller chairs. When people endeavour to sit in those, they have to make exactly the same physical movements that I do to sit in an average-sized chair. The smaller chairs are perfect for me to sit in. Other people can sit in them too. The photos there are hung at the level that is perfect for me to view. But guess what? Average people can view them too. So basically, I look at the physical, I look at the social through the photographs and such like. But what is also important to me? The personal. And I would like people to understand the methods I use to manage disabling interactions. And in doing so, what I need to do to maintain my sense of self and of utmost importance, my dignity. Consequently, in Kashula, people experience sound art called Whispering Forest and video, Little Things Matter. But this is the power, the joy, and the challenge of art. It enables people to consider and engage with very different perspectives, very different ideas and experiences in ways that can be constructive, enjoyable, confronting, and possibly unsettling. It is because art has the capacity to be readily accessible, though sometimes there are issues around that, that it can be a wonderful instrument for personal enjoyment, but very importantly, to instigate social change. It's everywhere. Thank you.
Artist and activist Deborah Keenahan. The final talk on the theme that art is everywhere is delivered by Indigenous novelist and essayist Melissa Lukashenko.
Jingiwala Jimbalung. Hello, friends. Naya Malala Walu. I see you. Nanang. I was going to talk about whales, but I changed my mind. Now I'm going to talk about architecture. I seem to constantly find myself surprised in middle age, which is a good condition for a writer to be in. When I was asked to talk about art for this event, I surprised myself by saying yes. And then I started to worry, because what do I know about art? I know about writing. And my books and essays and stories qualify as literature, but art with a capital A can feel like it belongs to other people, experts, painters and sculptors and musicians, people with degrees in art history, people who can spell the word Renaissance. I could write a book, I thought, on what I don't know about art. The US novelist Jane Smiley has said that every novel begins with the same premise: things are not what they seem. Now, this idea, which taken to its logical conclusion is quite the recipe for paranoia, struck me very hard when I first read it. Of course, things very often aren't what they seem, which then begs the question, and there you have it, the beginning of your novel or your play, your installation or your film. To imagine that things are not what they seem means to step beyond the conventional. And that's extremely difficult to do without something like breakfast in your belly and a roof over your head. Traditionally, the player of the Yiraki in Yolnu culture of northeast Arnhem Land was privileged as a musician. He was a specialist, and others provided for his family. But in the West today, part of the function of arts is to criticise and castigate the powerful. The artist frequently bites the hand that feeds her. And this bite might be corrective or homeopathic or cauterising, an essential service to the body politic. But essential or not, bites hurt. Little wonder that self-serving governments seek to shut artists down. And the more corrupt the government, the less interested it will be in funding critique expressed in literature or music or public installations or film. I was thinking about this public funding of art, and I was amazed. I was riveted by this fact that I came across recently, that Sir Christopher Wren, the renowned English architect who rebuilt London's churches after the Great Fire of 1666, once went unpaid for 14 years. 14 years! The English Parliament withheld half his salary to try and speed up the completion of St Paul's Cathedral. And meanwhile, he was busy building other edifices for kings and nobles. When he died, Wren was buried in the crypt of his magnum opus. His son had inscribed on his tombstone the legend, "Reader, if you seek his monument, look around you." And those same words are repeated in black marble immediately below that famous dome in central London. "Reader, if you seek his monument, look around you." Very moving. Wren was one of the instigators of the English Royal Society, which means that 3.5 centuries ago, he and some of his contemporaries formed an association for the better understanding of natural history. They wanted to closely examine the world that they were living in and put resources into that quest. Aboriginal peoples had been doing exactly this for tens of thousands of years, and we formalised our knowledge in continental bodies of art. But better late than never, I suppose. When Cook sailed to our east coast, part of the rationale for that voyage was the gaining of scientific knowledge. It would have been beyond his comprehension or the comprehension of Wren or of any European at the time to think that many kinds of science and art were far more sophisticated here than anywhere they called home. But then things are not always what they seem. St Paul's Cathedral still stands, literally a monument to Wren's genius and the willingness of the English Parliament to supply public funds to build it. Alas, to quote the Wiradjuri poet and intellectual Uncle Kevin Gilbert, when the English arrived here, we were confronted by barbarism, a people who never comprehended that there could be cathedrals of the spirit as well as of stone. Cathedrals of the spirit. What Kevin Gilbert referred to was a continent-wide paradigm, an unimaginably vast and complex web of story and song which developed here over 100,000 years of human society. The British came to our beloved estates and saw hostile wilderness. We know our countries as an enormous complex of sacred songlines. Our Jali Jali Billa, the weeping she-oak trees, which in some parts of Guri literature are interpreted as beautiful young maidens, or in the season of their flowering in far northern Australia as young warriors dressed in red ochre, were described by the colonist Rosa Praed as old hags. The bottlenose dolphin was to colonial eyes not the Yugambeh ancestor Gawanda, nor the warrior who created the red soil of the Quandamooka mainland, but rather a hideous monster. 2 centuries after the arrival of such barbarous thinking, the poet Anya Wolwitz excoriated the society that grew out of it in her wonderful poem, Australia. Like David Malouf in Jono, she effectively described a place in which poetry could never occur. Her poem begins, "You big ugly, you too empty, you desert with your nothing, 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 you scorched, suntanned, old too quickly, acres of suburbs watching the telly, you bore me, you nothing much with your big sea, beach, 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 you big, so what? I'm small, it's what's in. You silent on Sunday, nobody on your streets. You dead at night, you go to sleep too early. You scare me with your hopeless." Hard to imagine a more scathing view of 20th century Australia. Anna Wolwitz nailed it. But ironically, an immigrant, she also failed to see what Cook and Oxley and every other conquistador was oblivious to. Intellectual beauty and poetry and song have been here for tens of thousands of years and survive today. Desert country is very far from nothing, nothing, nothing. It hums with meaning and power to its first people. Art is everywhere in Australia, and we, her indigenes, have imbued every part of our continent with literature. Metaphor is literally an entire art form with us. Every valley and hill in Australia is a storied place. Every path and mountaintop and plain and watercourse has a name and belongs to the giant continental literature called by outsiders the songlines. Art is everywhere, but remains stubbornly resistant to the mainstream gaze. John Oxley rode up the Warra in 1823 and looked upon Magunjin, but didn't know he travelled in the track of the great Gabul, and he sailed blithely past the evidence of its moral struggle with Marung when he crossed the river bar. Cook recorded seeing pine and cedar and many smokes on the east coast, but he saw nothing he called art or philosophy. He was here for resources, not ideas. Things are not what they seem. Our art is everywhere on this continent. It has been everywhere Australians look or step or breathe or love for millennia. If you would seek our monuments, look around you. Bugabe.
Novelist Melissa Lukashenko, the last speaker in Arts and Minds, a special series of talks for ABC Arts Week. Cultural institutions like museums deepen public understanding of complex issues and science. Rose Hiscock is the Director of Museums and Collections at the University of Melbourne, which recently opened a new science gallery. The Melbourne Science Gallery is part of a global gallery network promoting science, art and innovation. In a Big Ideas from earlier this year, Rose argued that greater collaboration between science and the arts could be a global force for action on climate change.
For decades, exhibitions about drought, marine life, alternate energy, water, wind, glaciers, oceans, citizen science. In more recent years, the culture sector has been listening, learning and bringing together First Nations art knowledge and storytellers as a collaborative voice. Museums with natural history or science collections have become time capsules and repositories for the impacts of climate change. And they are active researchers contributing to science. The work of Museums Victoria, the Australian Museum, South Australian and West Australian Museums must be acknowledged for their research and their partnerships with universities around climate science. There are also global museums dedicated to climate change, arts organisations such as ClimArt, and activists, artist activists, who have been working with climate content for many years. However, given the urgency, the culture sector could be doing a lot more. So how could we use our collective power and key strengths to align around a code red for humanity? University museums are in a particularly strong position to respond to this responsibility. We can be overt in our messages, not fearful of political recriminations, and we have direct access to global institutes. Through the advocacy and leadership of Vice-Chancellor Duncan Maskell, the University of Melbourne has established two new strategies simultaneously, a climate futures initiative and a new cultural strategy, the Cultural Commons. Whilst these two initiatives may sound disparate, their formation is not coincidental. They are aligned through timing, leadership, appetite for change, and provide a compelling opportunity to bring together science, art, and public advocacy to tell stories that need to be told. Climate action is a complex problem that intersects our economy, migration, our security, our well-being, our way of life, our food security, our survival. However, what we need to do is disarmingly simple, quoting the IPCC report. Stabilising the climate will require strong, rapid, and sustained reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and reaching net zero CO2 emissions. What role can the cultural sector play in a way that politicians, policymakers, corporate boards, citizens, children take note to show that our time has expired? We have no more options. We must reach net zero CO2. How do we draw down on the bank of trust that we have methodically built? If every museum, gallery, library, theatre company, and performance space in the world, or as many as possible, linked up and dedicated their programs and spaces to a single subject, action on climate change, thereby advocating, inspiring, and communicating trustworthy information for individuals, children, companies, and leaders to commit to and obtain net zero CO2 as quickly as possible, I believe we could have a material impact. We could change the dial. Such a program should last as long as it takes to achieve agreement on targets and an outgoing program of action. It would draw down on our levels of trust, our reach, our commitment to the facts, and our ability to connect. It would engage creatives, scientists, storytellers, and importantly, children and young people in an interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary response. This might sound simple or naive. However, given the fashionability of roadmaps, here's some ideas on how we could achieve this. By working together on a single urgent issue such as climate, we can link up to build exceptional programs that benefit from collective intelligence, experts, market knowledge, and shared IP. The cultural sector has an extraordinary distribution network, which can be used to amplify and leverage our message. The Science Gallery Network is a good example of this approach in action. Established in Dublin in 2007 with the premise to inspire curious minds through the collision of art and science, the Science Gallery Network has expanded to 9 nodes in cities around the world, each in partnership with universities. And next year, the network will commence a globally linked program of science communication regarding climate action.
Rose Hiscock from the University of Melbourne. You can hear the full lecture by clicking the link on the Big Ideas homepage. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.